So again, let's start with a short meditation. So finding a nice, comfortable posture. As an act of loving kindness for yourself, let go of any external distractions and simply allow your awareness to descend into your body and become aware of sensations throughout the body. And using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. And all the muscles in the face soft and relaxed. The eyes soft and relaxed. Simply allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. And allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. Setting the mind in a state of ease and relaxation. Letting go of any hopes or fears, worries or concerns, about the past or the future. Simply allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment. Simply focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. And then with the eyes at least partially open, vacantly resting your gaze in the space in front of you, bring your attention to your own mind and simply observe your own mind. Simply be like an impartial observer or witness. Observing mental events as they arise and pass. So without following thoughts, without trying to get rid of thoughts, simply observe them as they arise and pass. Without grasping to them, without becoming distracted. If you're not sure where to focus, or you're simply becoming spaced out, then every now and again, deliberately generate a thought. Any thought will do. And simply watch that thought as it arises in your mind. and watch it as it disappears back into your mind. And then keep your attention right where it was, and simply wait for the next thought to appear in that space. And if you've got caught up in a thought and got carried away, then without getting frustrated or upset, simply relax, release grasping onto the thought, and very gently return to observing the mind. Simply keep coming back. And if you're feeling frustrated at not being able to observe the mind, then simply observe the frustration. And now release all appearances. And simply allow the mind to come to rest. Simply resting in awareness itself. Without really trying to do anything at all. Just be. Just be aware of being aware. Not paying any attention to any appearance that arises. Just resting in luminously clear awareness. So again, let's start with a short review of what we've covered so far. So of course, here we're following these outlines from Lamrim Chenmo, or the Great Treatise on the Stages of the Path to Enlightenment, a text by Lama Tsongkhapa, the founder of the Gluk school of Tibetan Buddhism. And this Lamrim structure is the normal structure that is presented in the practices in the Gluk school. And this approach to practice was introduced into Tibet by, again, Lama Atisha, great Indian master in the 11th century. And in this structure, the way the path to enlightenment is structured is in terms of the three types of person. In terms of making our precious human life meaningful at three levels of increasing capacity. And we saw that at the first level of making the life meaningful, the person of so-called small capacity, then our goal is simply a good future. And to help us to strive for that goal, we can reflect on death so that we can understand this precious human life's not going to last forever, and to inspire us to make it meaningful now and not delay it. And then also to reflect on what sorts of possible future experiences we could have, and understanding that we don't really want suffering future, and thereby develop an aspiration to strive for a good future, at least reducing or minimizing suffering. And then, of course, how to go about striving for that goal is who or what can we turn to for refuge from suffering? And the topic here, of course, then was refuge, taking refuge in the three jewels of Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And again, that the Buddha is a valid source of refuge because he is someone who has transcended suffering, so he knows how to do it, so he can really help us. But of course, the real refuge then is the teachings that he gives us. And the teachings here that can really help us to strive for a good future is this topic of karma, to understand that suffering comes from harmful actions, happiness from virtuous. And thereby reflecting on this, we would then understand that to find a good future, we need to have an ethical lifestyle, and thereby abandon harmful actions, engage in virtuous actions, and also to purify our mind of negative imprints, negative habits. So this is the Dharma that we would follow to strive for that good future. But of course, even if we manage to do that and have a good future, we're still stuck in this cycle of existence called samsara. And so then at the next level of making our life meaningful, we have the person of so-called medium capacity, where this person would then reflect on the fact that even this good existence within samsara is unsatisfactory, and that actually we can go beyond suffering altogether. But of course, to be able to do that, we first need to understand the nature of our existence, that we are stuck in this state of dukkha. Otherwise, of course, we're going to continue to look for happiness out there and never find it, of course, and still struggle and have problems and suffering. So the first step is to appreciate clearly the condition we find ourselves in, this condition of dukkha, and then to look at why are we in this state? Is there a reason we're in this state? To have a look at the underlying cause of this condition we find ourselves in. And then if we reflect on this, we can see that it's actually the mental afflictions that are the source of this condition we find ourselves in. And then looking at these mental afflictions, we can also then come to discover that they're coming from our distorted view of reality. They're coming from our grasping onto an independent me, independent objective world. And through that, the mental afflictions are arising, and that's driving our behavior, leading to our experiences. And then we can, from that, also come to appreciate that we can overcome this distorted view of reality by coming to realize the nature of reality, developing this wisdom. And then if we do that, then we can overcome that ignorance, which therefore means we will no longer have mental afflictions or the suffering that that produces. So then we can understand that it's possible to transcend this type of existence we find ourselves in. So then we could really develop the aspiration for liberation. So that's where we are now, is having a look at, we've already had a look at the state of dukkha that we're in, and we're still currently looking at then these mental afflictions that are the source of that suffering. And so by reflecting on this and coming to appreciate this, then we can really develop this aspiration to be liberated from samsara altogether. And so therefore, there yesterday, what we did was to have a look at that process. We looked at this suffering and its causes chart. And we saw that really from this fundamental ignorance, this grasping on independent me, independent world, then when we experience things in the world and we have pleasant and unpleasant experiences, that those experiences, together with this false, distorted view of reality, would lead us to naturally assume that these objects that, for example, we have a pleasant experience with respect, that there must be some attractive quality in the object that's causing my pleasant feeling. Or if I'm having an unpleasant feeling, we'll naturally assume there must be some unattractive quality in that object that's causing my unpleasant feeling. So we would naturally see these objects as either inherently attractive or unattractive, depending on our experience. But then, of course, that will lead to the further step of the mental afflictions, because if we're having a pleasant feeling and we're believing that the object is the cause of my pleasant feeling, then, of course, we want pleasant feelings, and therefore we think that that object is the source of that, so we try to get that object, so we have attachment to those objects. Or if it's an unpleasant feeling, and that object seems to be the cause of my unpleasant feeling, of course we don't want unpleasant feelings, so we try as hard as we can to get that object out of our face. So we have aversion. So this is how attachment and aversion arises through our pleasant and unpleasant experiences, together with this false belief. Of course, if we don't have a distorted view of reality, then yes, we will still have pleasant, unpleasant experiences, but we wouldn't react to that. We wouldn't then automatically assume that the cause of those is in the object. So they wouldn't lead to the mental afflictions. But of course, those mental afflictions of attachment and aversion, then if we reflect on that, we can appreciate that the other mental afflictions are coming out of one or a combination of those. And that's what's driving our behavior, and that's going to lead to our experiences. So we saw from that chart then, if we really want to overcome dukkha, then we need to overcome this fundamental ignorance, this grasping onto independent me, independent world. But of course, that's going to take some time, because we not only need to correctly understand the nature of reality, but we need to internalize that, of course. We need to come to realize that directly in meditation. So that's going to take some time and effort. So that's the long-term strategy to overcome dukkha, the cycle of samsara, is to come to realize this emptiness. So we need also then an effective short-term strategy, how to at least reduce the negative impact of this process while we're working on that. And we had a look at that at each of one of those steps. And we saw that there are a number of different things we can do depending on which step we're at. But one of the core elements that we saw, one of the key elements that will enable us to implement some of these short-term strategies, is our capacity for mindfulness. Because, for example, at step two, where we are experiencing pleasant and unpleasant sensations or feelings, one very practical short-term strategy is simply to observe those, not get caught up in them. Of course, to be able to observe those in daily life, we need to be present, we need to be mindful. Also at step four, same approach, very effective. When we notice any mental affliction arising in our mind, like attachment, aversion, or jealousy, if we can simply be mindful and be present and notice it when it starts to arise, then we can avoid getting caught up in it and acting on it. Just simply observe it rise and pass. And even at step six, mindfulness is helpful. Step six, in particular, if we are having some unpleasant, painful experience, if we can simply be present with that, to be mindful, then we will not react to that unpleasant experience by having aversion. Because aversion to our unpleasant experiences, all that does is it magnifies our suffering. So if we can simply be present with that, we would avoid a lot of unnecessary self-induced suffering. So in many of these areas, the key is mindfulness, is really to develop that ability to be present and observe what is going on without reacting. So this is one of the main elements within our short-term strategy that can really help us in our daily life. And then, of course, we went on to yesterday to have a look at then the process. You know, this is the process of how ignorance leads to mental afflictions, leads to our experiences. But of course, that process is not just in this life, where this process is going on life after life. So then we had a look in the text as to how that process works in terms of this cycle of rebirth. And so we had a look there yesterday at this death process, and then how through that a imprint is activated to determine what our next life is going to be. And then we had this intermediate state or bardo state between this life and the next, and then how that then progressed on to the next life. So we then had some understanding of the big process of cycling life after life. And so this reflection then can help us to appreciate that we can actually transcend this whole cycle. Because if we can really overcome this ignorance, we can transcend the whole cycle of samsara. So these sorts of reflections that we looked at yesterday are going to be very helpful to develop this aspiration of the person of medium capacity. The aspiration, the mind intent on liberation, which normally is translated into English as renunciation. But again, as we can understand, that word renunciation is a little bit misleading. We're really talking about this mind intent on liberation. What we're going to do this morning is have a look at another reflection that can help us achieve the same goal, to achieve the aspiration, the mind intent on liberation. So those reflections yesterday, of course, we were effectively reflecting on the first two noble truths. There is another reflection that is very similarly related to that, that is also a very powerful technique to appreciate how we're stuck in this cycle and the fact that we can break free, and thereby from that reflection also develop this mind intent on liberation. And that is, in your outlines, it starts towards the bottom of page 18, where it says, reflection from the viewpoint of the 12 dependent arisings. So that is the second way of helping us to cultivate this aspiration, this mind intent on liberation. And of course, those 12 dependent arisings are described here in your Wheel of Life Bhava Chakra chart. So if you want to get that out, we'll go through that now. So of course, already we've touched on this chart a little bit, but now I'd like to give a more extensive presentation of the whole chart, and in particular these 12 diagrams here that this subject matter is pointing to. So maybe a few general points before we go into these 12 diagrams that are around the outside of the wheel. So first we have that this wheel symbolizing this cycle of samsara is being held by a monster who's called Yama. Yama is the lord of death. And so Yama is symbolizing death and impermanence. And so you can see that Yama is biting into the wheel and holding it with his hands and feet. And so that is symbolizing the fact that we are literally trapped in the jaws of death, that we're trapped in the cycle of birth, aging, death. And so this is what Yama is symbolizing. There are a number of things there that also have significance. For example, on Yama, on his head, he has five skulls. The five symbolize the five aggregates, and the fact that they're skulls is symbolizing the impermanence of the five aggregates. So the body and the mind are impermanent, changing moment by moment, constantly changing. Sometimes the two hands and two feet of Yama that are holding the wheel. Sometimes that's also said to symbolize the cycle of birth, aging, sickness, and death that we go through, those four elements. Also, down the bottom, there's a tiger skin. I've never really got a good, clear explanation about that, but recently I read in one book that it was said to symbolize fear, that fearfulness, that we are caught in this cycle, we're trapped in this cycle with a lot of fear. But that's only one place I've saw that description. I haven't really seen any other explanation of that. Then, of course, also we see outside the wheel, we see Buddha up in the top right-hand corner, meaning the Buddha has transcended samsara, beyond samsara. And he's pointing over to the right. And normally, over to the right here in the top left-hand corner, you normally just see the moon in the sky. The moon is symbolizing nirvana. The reason being is that in samsara, it's said that we are tormented by the heat of the mental afflictions. Just like in the hot days, midday sun, we're tormented by the heat of the sun. Whereas at nighttime, the light of the moon has sort of a cooling effect. So therefore, nirvana has this cooling effect. We're no longer tormented by the heat of the mental afflictions. So that's why often nirvana is symbolized by the moon. Here we have some writing, and on the top there's a round object. I'm not sure if that's supposed to be the moon, possibly. But this writing also sometimes you'll find in the top right-hand corner. And here, because I think this particular diagram, someone within the Tibetan tradition was drawing it, is Tibetan writing. And this writing says the following. Translated into English, it says, "Undertaking this and leaving that, enter into the teaching of the Buddha. Like an elephant in a thatched house, destroy the forces of the Lord of Death. Those who with thorough conscientiousness practice this disciplinary doctrine will forsake the wheel of birth, bringing suffering to an end." So that's what that says. Then if we go right to the middle of the diagram, in the middle here, we see the three animals. We see a pig, a rooster, and a snake. These, of course, are symbolizing the three poisons, because the three poisons is the source of samsaras. That's why the three animals are in the middle. The pig is symbolizing ignorance, the snake, aversion, and the rooster, attachment. In this particular diagram, you see that each animal is grabbing the tail of the other animal. In a more traditional diagram, you often see the pig grabbing the tail of the rooster and the snake, symbolizing that out of the mouth of ignorance comes attachment and aversion. But this is also okay because each one, of course, reinforces the others. So these are the three poisons. And then if we go to the next circle outer, we see it's divided into two sections. The white, left half is white, the right half is black. These are talking about, of course, our actions that are motivated by those mental afflictions. So the white side, of course, is symbolizing the virtuous actions, the black side, non-virtuous, harmful actions. And so we can see here that if we do virtuous actions, then figuratively speaking, we will be moving in an upward direction to a good future. So we see the beings in that diagram are moving upward. Whereas in the other side, the black side, the non-virtuous actions, if we engage in non-virtuous harmful actions, then figuratively speaking, we move downward to a not a good future. So therefore, we see them moving in a downward direction. And so, therefore, if we want to look at what types of existences then we can expect because of those virtuous, non-virtuous actions, then we have that diagram, which we the next section out, that's divided into five, sometimes divided into six. And so we already had a look at those sections which depict the different types of existences within samsara, the human realm, the deva realm, the asura realm, the animal realm, the preta realm, and the narak realm. And so then from that we can understand that we are cycling within those different types of existences depending on our mental afflictions and our actions. And we can be cycling, going between various existences, moving upward and downward in all of those existences. So is there any questions on any of the aspects of the diagram apart from the 12 diagrams? Because that's what we're going to look at next. Anything other than that?
Sometime later, could I get that quote from you?
Sure.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. No problem. We can do that. Yeah.
Looks like in this barren.
In the like diagram, yeah.
Hungry goats or something. There's a king or something. They looks like they have some kind of organization.
I mean, of course, in each of these realms, there's often, in the preta realm, there are often then some that are better off than others and have control over others and that. So that's certainly possible. Yes. Yeah.
Is this in reference when sometimes there's white karma or black karma?
Yeah, white is symbolizing virtuous, black is non-virtuous. Yeah, that's right. Okay, then let's look at the 12 links then. So these 12 links are describing, like, very similar to what we've covered yesterday, you know, these six steps and the suffering and its causes. These 12 links describe the similar process, but these 12 links in particular are describing the process of death and rebirth, how it works. So let's have a look at the 12 links. If we start up around 1 o'clock at the top here, we see a person with a stick. This, of course, is a blind person using a stick because they can't see where they're going. So this, of course, is symbolizing ignorance, that we are blinded by ignorance. We can't see where we're going. And because we're blinded by ignorance, then we end up with mental afflictions, and that is driving our behavior. And so link number two is talking about our actions that are motivated by ignorance and the mental afflictions. And here this is symbolized by a person on a potter's wheel. There's a spinning wheel with a clay, and the person is forming a pot from the clay. And so this second link here is translated as formative actions. So what this is saying is that depending on what actions we do now, this is literally forming what our future life is going to look like. So that's why it's called formative actions. Then in link three, this is symbolizing consciousness, because every action we do leaves an imprint on the mind or consciousness. And here, consciousness is symbolized by a monkey in front of a house with five windows and a door. The five windows are symbolizing our five sense faculties, and the door, the mental faculty. And so what this monkey is symbolizing is the fact that we are constantly jumping between the senses and our mental faculty. And so often we hear this saying that we have a crazy monkey mind. You know, our mind is jumping all over the place. So that's what this is symbolizing. Then, of course, every action we do that leaves an imprint on the mind is carried along the continuum of the mind. And then at some point later, that imprint ripens as a result. And remember in the presentation of karma, we said one of the results can be this fruitional or fully ripened result, which was another life. And so these 12 links are only talking about these particular actions. So then at some point in the future, of course, that imprint will then ripen as the next life. And the next life begins, as we saw, when the consciousness, the mind of the intermediate being, conjoins with the fertilized egg in the womb, if it's going to be human, of course. And so that is what is symbolized here in link 4, which is called name and form. And the diagram is a boat with a number of people in it, sometimes 1, 2, 3, 4, different numbers of people. Name and form. Form is the body, and that is symbolized here by the boat. Name is consciousness, and that is symbolized by the people in the boat. So the mind can, as we saw, can be divided up in many ways. And in the five aggregates presentation, of course, we divided it into four. So then for the five aggregates, you would have one boat with four people in it. But here, I can't really see how clearly how many people, but it doesn't matter because the people collectively is the mind. So the body is the boat, the people is the mind. So the body is like the vessel for the mind. The boat is the vessel for the people. Then as that fertilized egg in the womb starts to develop, the fetus and embryo and fetus develop, then at some point the sense faculties become operational, and that is link number 5 then. Link 5 here is called the 6 sense spheres. So that symbolized that the point at which the sense faculties become operational. So again, this is symbolized usually by a house with 5 windows and a door. The 5 windows are the sense faculties, the door, the mental faculty. So of course, when the sense and mental faculty become operational, then they contact their respective object. So that is link number 6 here, contact, which is graphically represented by a couple making love. So there's a lot of contact going on there. So of course, when the sense faculty contacts its object, then we experience that object as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So we have feeling arising or sensation arising. And that here then is link number 7, feeling. And again, this is quite graphically represented by a person with an arrow stuck in their eye. So there's obviously a lot of feeling going on there. And then, of course, as we saw yesterday, from feeling, if we have pleasant feeling, often comes attachment. Unpleasant feeling, aversion. So from feeling comes attachment and aversion. And here, the next link, link number 8, is craving. Now, this link, craving here, is a particular type of attachment. And this is talking about what is happening as we're approaching death. That as we're approaching death, then literally it seems like we're going out of existence. So we are craving to life itself. And so here, craving is symbolized by a person with some alcohol, craving alcohol. And then the link 9 is grasping. And that's symbolized here by a monkey grasping fruit in a tree. So the difference between craving and grasping is that grasping is an intensification. So we initially crave something and then we actually grasp, we actually try to get it. So when we're craving for life because we seem like we're going out of existence, then we actually try to grasp to life itself. That grasping to life itself then activates a imprint in our mind, a karmic imprint, and that activated karmic imprint is link number 10. So link 10 here is called becoming, and that is here symbolized by a pregnant woman about to give birth. So likewise, we have now activated through the death process this karmic imprint, and it's about to give birth to a new life. And then, of course, the new life begins with birth. So that is link number 11 here of birth, which is symbolized here by a woman actually giving birth. And then, of course, what follows birth is aging and death. And that is link number 12. Link number 12 here is symbolized by an old person carrying a sack on their back. And in the sack is a corpse. So this is aging and death. Becoming, sometimes it's called, translated as existence or potential existence. I think if we look in the Lamrim outlines here, the 12 are listed. And here it's called, potential existence. It's translated as potential existence. So these are the 12 links. So by reflecting on these 12 links, we can see that where is aging and death coming from? It's coming from birth. Where's birth coming from? Potential existence. We can keep going back, 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 back. We can see that the cycle of birth, aging, death is really coming from our ignorance. So then we can understand this situation we find ourselves in. But then we can understand that if we eliminate ignorance, then we eliminate formative actions and we eliminate each of the links in the head of it. Therefore, we can eliminate birth, aging, and death. Therefore, from those forward and reverse way of looking at these 12 links, we can develop the aspiration for liberation, the mind intent on liberation. So there's a question.
Yes. Is there any significance to Yama having the teeth and the nails dug into the four links that are in there? Or am I reading too much into it? So, I mean, there's actual...
Oh, in those specific links.
Yeah, so becoming and aging and death. Stronger holds?
I don't think so. I mean, normally the position of the 12 diagrams is like this, but I've seen in some where it's sort of rotated a little bit, the 12. But this is the most common positioning, and I mean, of course there could be something, but I've never heard anything about why the hand is particularly grabbing, you know, number 3 or so forth. Maybe it's just coincidence. There may be a reason, but I haven't heard or read about anything like that. Yeah.
I'm just curious on the craving, the guy drinking alcohol. There's something behind him that vaguely looks like a swan boat or something.
No, I think that's the large tub of lots of alcohol. Yeah, because this is a sort of a Tibetan version, so I think this is like what's called chang. So they have... which is like the Tibetan old-style beer, which is fermented millet. So then they usually have a big tub of it that's fermenting away, and I guess that that's what that is. So one bowl is not enough, you know. I think that's what it's symbolizing. Yeah?
I've read that the difference between, like, number 8 and 9, craving and grasping, is... in number 8, the mind is saying, I want this. And in number 9, it's saying, I will have this.
Yeah, it's the next step. That's right. Yeah. It's 8, the craving is, we're wanting something. And 9 is like, I'm going to get it. And then we try and grab it.
Break the link at 8, between 8 and 9?
I mean, we can sort of work at each one of those steps. But again, I think this step of feeling and the step, well, feeling... the feeling and the step of craving, I think these can be good. I mean, here, of course, this craving is talking about at the time of death. And so at that time, we're already going through the death process, and it really is just an automatic thing. Unless, of course, we've developed the ability to be mindful and we're quite high on the path. But, of course, in general, in daily life, then the links of feeling and attachment and aversion are good points to break it. That's true.
Okay.
Yeah. Either one of them or a combination of them, yeah.
It's not necessarily in the diagram, but on rebirth, what other than karma is there of our spiritual practice is taken with us? Like, to exaggerate, say there's somebody who's close to nirvana in their path, and are they reborn and just as likely to become a drug addict and have no spiritual
practice? No. All of the imprints of, because, you know, every time we have a mental affliction, there's an imprint. But also, of course, the positive quality, there's imprints. There's imprints for everything. So, therefore, if we've done a lot of good things in this life, we have a lot of positive imprints. Which means in the next life, as we are growing up, if we find ourselves in good conditions, those imprints will ripen. Meaning that, as we start to enter into the spiritual path in the next life, things will happen very quickly because we have a lot of imprints for it. You know, maybe in this life we struggled a lot to understand emptiness and we meditated and we put a lot of effort into it. That will bear fruit in that in the next life when we start to look at emptiness, we'll go, oh, that's easy. No problem. Well,
realized emptiness in a previous life?
No, yeah, so technically what we're talking about here is rebirth.
Right. But
which means uncontrolled, means we have no control. It's out of our hands. It's basically, at our level, it's how we've led our life is going to determine the future.
You carry your stuff?
Oh, yeah, of course. All your stuff's carried. Yes. Okay. A couple of things to mention here. This word Rinpoche. Yeah, sure. Is Rinpoche means precious one. Precious one. And normally this is given to someone who is sort of at this level. And that is that someone who has achieved a significant level in the spiritual path and often has either some control or direction in where they go. And so then what they do, as we mentioned yesterday, they try to find where they ended up because that person has a lot of massive amount of positive imprints. Meaning that if they can find that person as a child and then provide good conditions as a child, when they start to become a young adult, then a lot of these imprints will start ripening when they start to study and meditate. And then even as a teenager, they will be some amazing being because they've reactivated a lot of these imprints. So this, therefore, this person is precious. They're a Rinpoche. What we need to unfortunately remember is that this system was sometimes abused. Meaning in ancient Tibet, if a monastery or nunnery said they had a Rinpoche, the community would give more money. So unfortunately, the system has sometimes been abused, meaning that if we now see someone call Rinpoche this, Rinpoche that, unfortunately, we can't assume that they are a high-level practitioner. Because it has been abused. In fact, a couple of Tibetan masters I've heard say that maybe they should scrap this system because of this. So we need to be careful. That's the bottom line. If someone's called Geshe this, Geshe that, Rinpoche this, Rinpoche that, Lama this, Lama that, we should not blindly follow them. I mean, in general, to be a qualified student of Buddhism, we should not blindly follow anyone. Even if the Buddha was here, we shouldn't do that. So, therefore, we need to check them out. And unfortunately, in our modern society, this is not what people do. They often see someone called Rinpoche this, Lama that, Guru this, and they go, oh, wow, they must be, you know, and then they just blindly follow them. And, of course, sometimes, again, also, you get people self-appointing them as Guru this, Lama that, Rinpoche this.
That's even worse. I mean, this, unfortunately, from what I understand, is happening quite a lot in China now with Tibetan monks and stuff. They go to China and they think, ooh, you know, the ones that are not really practicing, but think, oh, I can make a lot of money here. And so they call themselves Rinpoche something or Lama this, and then a lot of the Chinese followers are just throwing money at them. Exactly. Exactly. And that's what's happening. I mean, and His Holiness Dalai Lama's been commenting on that a few times. You know, so just a word of caution, you know. But, I mean, technically, if the procedure's done properly, then yes, that person should have been recognized as someone in the past life. But, of course, if that person in this life doesn't continue to develop, then those imprints, and they... that can go the other way. I mean, but they start the life with a lot of good imprints, but what they do in their, this life is going to determine whether they keep going or it sort of slowly goes backwards.
My understanding is that a lot of Lama or Rinpoches or even some cases, even they, even after they realize that
oh, sorry, yeah.
They wouldn't admit.
Yeah, yeah, sorry, I forgot to, there was the next part of your question. Yeah, good, thanks. So, I didn't answer the whole question.
Just take their word for it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they would not tell you.
Yeah, yeah. So the other part you said about that, he said he hadn't realized emptiness. Two things, of course, is that just because someone's a Rinpoche doesn't mean that they have directly realized emptiness in the past life. No pervasion. It means that they have, in theory, if it's a correct person identified, they have really progressed in the path. It doesn't mean 100% that they have directly realized emptiness. Maybe, yeah. Not etched in stone. And like I said, unfortunately, this system is a little bit abused. And then the other point is that I think, as I already mentioned on the other day, one of the measures of when we investigate a teacher is that one of the qualities that someone will really develop in large amounts as they progress in the spiritual path is humility. So if this person in public is saying, I've realized emptiness, there's a high probability that they're just delusional. If, yeah, so... You know, people ask the Dalai Lama, you know, are you enlightened? And he says, I'm just a simple Buddhist monk who can't even meditate well. Mm-hmm. So, in private though, if you have a personal teacher and they have realized emptiness or they have some high realization, if they believe that by that demonstrating that to you, you will be inspired in a good way, they will do that in private. If they believe that even in private, if they do that, you'll just start worshipping them, they will never do that.
Okay.
I mean,
I feel more comfortable with the answer now.
I mean, yeah. I mean, I've had connection with a few teachers where they've, obviously I'm not a very good student, but they've never showed anything to me. But friends of mine have said, wow, you know, blah, 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 about this teacher. And I'm going, well, they didn't tell me that. So I'm obviously these people. Yeah.
Perhaps too much involvement on this. Do you have time to comment on what's going on in China with respect to...
Well, I don't really know so much.
Okay. I'm always looking for insight. Well, because there's a lot going
on. Yeah, I know. No, I really don't have much contact there, so I'm not an authority on that. So I'll leave that out. I'll leave that to other people who are more qualified to comment. Okay.
I'm having, it seems like a tense shift.
Like, a what, sorry?
Like a tense shift, like a verb tense shift.
Oh.
So like, you are in ignorance and basically the first ones are the formation.
The actions, yeah.
Yeah. Then you, the senses develop and then... implanted on the union.
I think to answer your question, I've still got more to talk about the 12 links. I think in the next couple of presentations,
it'll become
more clear. So let's do that because it's also mentioned in your text here. if you go into the section on 12 links, the first paragraph just lists the 12, and then it talks about different classification of the various factors, the way we can classify them. And the first one is that says there are four types: projecting factors, projected factors, actualizing factors, and actualized factors. So let's have a look at what they are. So we talked about briefly, this projecting karma, this karma that projects a new life. So then what are the projecting factors is, of course, ignorance, which is leading to link two. Link two is the projecting action. But, of course, that is then imprinted on the consciousness. So these three are the projecting factors. And then what is projected is the result of that is then link 4, 5, 6, and 7. The fact that we have the consciousness joining with the fertilized egg, sense faculties developing, contact and feeling. So this is what is then projected.
So the consciousness joining with the fertilized egg, that's number 4.
Yeah. Yeah, 4 is when it's conjoined, yes.
Okay, so like the depiction of sexual union here, that's just a symbol. That's not actually something that's happening.
No. You mean the contact?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's just symbolizing contact.
Okay.
No, it's not, it's just contact. That's all.
Conception.
No, it's not symbolizing that. It's just contact. So this is projected. Then it talks about actualizing and actualized. So remember, what is actualizing this projecting karma is then the craving and the grasping, and then the fact that it's the activated imprint. So the actualizing factors, what's going to actualize that projecting karma is link 8, 9, and then 10. And then, of course, what is actualized is link number 11 and 12. So what we can understand from this, or begin to understand, well, in fact, let me give the next presentation and then maybe it's easier. So in the next, in the same paragraph in your outline, it says the 12 factors, moreover, are subsumed under the three paths, those of afflictions, karma, and suffering. So remember, this is also a parallel presentation to the one before about suffering and its causes. And so, of course, the causes of suffering are the mental afflictions and then the actions leading to suffering. So this 12 links also comes in the same sphere. So which of these 12 links is mental afflictions, which is action, and which is suffering? So which of the 12 links is mental afflictions?
One, two.
One, two, two's.
Two,
eight. No, one, yeah, one.
Eight.
Nine, yes. Yeah. 1, 8, 9. They're the mental afflictions.
Two is samskaras.
Yeah, which is karma, action. Two is formative actions. So
the fourth skanda. Mental factors.
No, it's not. It's the mental factors, because this is called samskara karma. The link two is samskara karma, which means it's karma motivated by the samskaras. So Which ones is action or karma then in the 12?
Well, two.
Two.
Six.
No.
Contact?
No.
Oh,
seven.
No.
No, it's seven.
Nine.
No, no.
Grasping.
No. We're only out of numbers. Ten. Becoming. Remember, ten was the activated imprint. So this is karma.
Isn't nine the intention?
No. Number nine, well, nine is the mental affliction. Yeah. Craving and grasping.
The intention. I'm gonna get this.
So the action is 2 and 10, and then of course the rest is dukkha or suffering, the result.
So birth doesn't count as an action just because it's not like it's not chosen.
Sorry?
Well, on 11, birth jati. Is that, I mean, to me that seems like an action, except that it's like maybe it's not chosen action, you just.
It's an action. Well, birth is the result of the action.
Gotcha. Right. That's, okay.
Right. So then suffering is all the other links. They all are the result.
Why is it three mental affliction?
Because three is just consciousness. We have mental afflictions in the consciousness, but it's just consciousness. We're just talking about consciousness. And then one more presentation. Here, following, it says the number of lifetimes required to complete all 12 factors. It says it is possible at shortest to complete all 12 action factors in 2 lifetimes. Even at the longest, completion of all 12 factors will be delayed no longer than 3 lifetimes. So let's see what that means. So, in a past life, then, of course, we have ignorance that led to mental afflictions, which led us to create some action, to do some action, which was deposited as an imprint on the consciousness. So, in a past life, we had link 1, 2, and 3 happening. Everyone's okay with that so far? Then, in the present life, so this is describing the 3 lifetimes version, and then I'll talk about the 2 lifetimes after that. So when I say past life, that could have been in the last one, or maybe who knows when, but some past life. Then in the present life, then of course we have this imprint in our mind. And so then in this present life, at the end of this life, we activate that imprint. So that is which links then? 8, 9, and 10. So at the end of the present life, we have craving and grasping to life, and then that activates the imprint that we created sometime in the past, number 2. Then, of course, that activated imprint at the end of this life produces the next life. And so in the next life, we have all the other links, 4, 5, 6, 7, 11, and 12.
We have 3.
Well, I mean, you can sort of put 3 everywhere here, really. 11, 12. So this is how one cycle of this is completed over a number of lives. The 2 lifetime version would be that in this present life, we do an action that's imprinted on the mind, and then in this very life, that same action at the end of the life gets activated. a little bit more unlikely because it takes time for these actions to mature. But it's possible. So it could be earlier in this life we did some very heavy good thing. And that created a positive imprint in our mind, and we've had a very good virtuous life. At the end of this life, that good virtuous imprint ripens and we end up as a human again in the next life. So that means that that entire cycle completes in two lives. But more common, it would be like this. So we can see from this that there are multiple cycles simultaneous. Because in this life, we could be starting many other cycles. So these are sort of concurrent. So does this help or more confusion?
It helped with the first question, but it's... I totally had the first question until you went into this.
But
now it's a different question.
Okay.
Now it is, but why couldn't... I think it's the projected and the projecting.
Okay.
That have me muddled.
Okay.
But I feel like it wouldn't one lifetime encompass all of these. Wouldn't you... the only ones I can see is that the things from your past lives coming in. Okay, I think I got it.
Okay. Yeah.
Isn't there a doctrine about you're only so many you have to get out, a stream enter? Like once you've made it a certain far, in the path, that then there's only so many
you're going to go. Yeah, I mean, we're jumping ahead a bit now. But... I think in the next session already, we're going to talk about the path to liberation. So we've got this path to nirvana and the path to enlightenment. And often within the path to nirvana, we can just see whether we're going to nirvana or enlightenment, we can look at that progress and we can sort of pick out very important steps along the way. And how we describe that, we can do that a number of ways. One way that's often described within the Theravada traditions for the path to nirvana is that they pick what's called these four results that are significant points in the way. And the first one is the one you've mentioned, this what's called stream enterer. And a stream enterer is someone who's had a direct realization of the nature of reality. Because that is a very significant point in the spiritual path. It's often said that once we get to that point, we're in a one-way ticket out of samsara. Before that, we can sort of maybe, backwards and forwards a little bit. But once we get there, it's said that we're really just, it's a matter of time. It still may take quite some time, but at least we're sort of on a one-way ticket out. So that's what stream enterer is talking about. In the Bodhisattva path, they wouldn't use that terminology, but the equivalent terminology is that you have direct realization of emptiness, and then the Bodhisattva becomes an Arya Bodhisattva. Oh. So that would be the equivalent point on the Mahayana path. And again, in the Mahayana, they don't use that terminology of stream enterer. But they'd say rather at that point on the Mahayana path, you become an Arya being. An Arya being, I think I mentioned already, is in the context of Four Noble Truths, is someone who's had a direct realization of the nature of reality.
But it could be just a glimpse, as you say.
Glimpse? No. Glimpse comes way before. We can have a glimpse of that now.
But I thought you said glimpse was where the stream entry.
No. Stream entry is a direct realization. Direct realization. So now we can have a little glimpse or taste, but our mind is not stable enough for that to be a realization. For that we need shamatha. So yes, we can sit down now and have a glimpse or taste of emptiness. No problem. But it's very weak because our mind is not very clear and focused, so it doesn't impact us very much. But someone there who has shamatha, and then they penetrate, they have a direct realization. I mean, that is very significant. Yeah, last question, then we'll break.
Usually that direct realization is during the meditation.
Yes, during the meditation.
When they are out of meditation, they are expecting normal.
Yeah, outside of meditation, of course, we're doing this illusory-like emptiness. So outside of meditation, we are trying to realize the flip side of emptiness, that the fact that everything's a dependent arising, interdependent. So we're working on the nature of reality in daily life, but in terms of dependent arising, that everything is a dependent phenomena. But I'll talk more about that later, of course. That's coming in the Vipassana section. Okay, let's take a break and come back at 10:45. There's one or two more things I want to mention about this 12 links, and then we're going to move on to the next part of the medium capacity, that is, what are the practices that we need to engage in to achieve nirvana? Of course, we're talking about the three higher trainings, ethics, concentration, wisdom. So I want to briefly talk about those. Of course, ethics we've already talked about in terms of the non-virtues of virtues, but I want to talk a little bit about concentration and wisdom. So that's after the break.